But yeah, so just go ahead and ask any question.
At first, I shied away from the idea of naming it object-oriented science, because there is object-oriented programming
Well,
in computer science. You know that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's why I picked it. Because it
Okay.
is the same,
And yes.
and it would mean a different thing in a different application, I guess.
Yeah. And object-oriented programming is a step lower than using design patterns.
Well, it depends on what context you put them in. If object-oriented programming is the object within the living context, then the interface with the living systems, as and that's the direction I've taken it in my PLOP paper on mining living quality, was to consider the living systems that serve and are served by the software as being where you look to improve the interface between
Yeah.
the software and the living system. So that was my approach there, and it may call for being really clear about that, of
Yeah.
course, but
Well, I sympathize with that approach, although I would have to change my own wording in a certain sense to bring this in harmony. Usually, on a philosophical level, I talk about the world of entities and the ancient Greek way of ordering the world was to see these entities as objects having properties or as things having properties and to put these things in categories according to these properties.
Well, the
And
okay.
the opposition to this is to look at the world as a world of relationships. What, for example, Whitehead suggested in a kind of vague way in his book, what is it called? What's his book, Whitehead? Sorry, Process and Reality, where he fights an object view of the world and suggests a relationship view of the world.
I support both, I guess. I use this very flexible strategy that so far I haven't had a chance to discuss with much of anyone, even though I present it and I state it as my dual paradigm view, that we need both a conceptual reality and the natural world reality, the one being defined in our minds and the other not. And the other that we take a study relationship to, that is external, the external world and the internal world, and have slightly different terms and meanings for them as two different discussions. Because the external world is full of independently organized things that behave on their own, and the internal world isn't generally. It's things arranged in a fixed set of relationships according to how we imagine them. So, I think it's two different worlds, and sorting it out, I don't think it's perfectly sorted out between object-oriented or object world versus relationship world. Clearly, pattern language is about understanding of the relationships that you have some influence over. That, or at least as far as Alexander, and seeing the whole relationships and the living relationships as distinct from the repetitious and lifeless one. And I see that as addressing the natural world rather than a conceptual world. It's not a theory, it's a practice. And so, I see that as you go back and forth between them, you're going from theory to practice to theory to practice, and you're trying to coordinate them. And that's where my diagram in the paper, my figure number one, is and also that we discussed, that I discussed at least on Helene's website thing, I forget the name of it, her discussion page.
If we compare this to the way that software people use this,
okay,
mainly I'm a software person, then actually what you say in this paper makes a lot of sense, because originally 30 years ago the way of programming was quite different from this object-oriented programming. There were data, and there were code. There was code. The code operated on the data and produced new data, and code and data were separate things. This was called procedural programming. Programs were more or less a sequence of commands that made the computer operate on the data.
Well, it still is, except that you have higher level languages now, and you can't.
Yeah, but the next step was to put structure to both the data and the code. The data got things like records, containers for different kinds of data that could be manipulated as a whole. And the code was structured into functions that could be used as a whole and called like a mathematical function and do something and could be reused. And this was maybe 20 years ago, the situation 20 years ago. And then came the objects, and the objects joined, the software objects, and object-oriented programs. They joined the data structures and put some code into the data structures and connected it to the data.
So I don't really understand that. I mean,
I can make an example. You would have, for example, a class of objects, and this class would describe rectangles, for example.
Okay, and what would be in a class of rectangles?
In the class of rectangles would be the definition that the rectangle has a width and a breadth and a height.
And it would be, some would be only their boundary, and some would also be their insides.
And you could now, for example, add some code so that that an instance of this class, a certain rectangle, would give you its area or its boundary length. And this could be implemented as code that is connected to the data. To call this object would mean that you would ask this object, please give me your area. And at that point, this code contained in the object that's actually contained in the class, because it's the same for all objects of the class, it would calculate automatically the current area from the current values of the width and the height.
Okay.
So this object-oriented programming produces new elements that that unify data and code, and in a way, philosophically, this is very satisfying, because this approach of objects that are described by data, like the ancient Greek did, is connected to a relationship mechanism. This area calculation is not really a relationship, it's something internal. But this code could also refer to some connection. For example, this rectangle could be part of a system describing arbitrary geometrical systems. And the rectangle could contain a reference to the system it belongs to. So one can build systems of such objects.
Right. Now, I don't think I'll ever be able to be capable of understanding that at a higher level. What I do, I guess I'm coming down from coming to it from a top-down sort of mental picture of thinking as software objects as services, taking inputs and making outputs, and so that they are little utilities that are intended to provide a full complement of tools to address a particular use, sort of like an app.
This input-output view is much older. It was the original view of what the program does. The program is some code. Mm-hmm. You give him some input, it does the processing and produces some output.
Right, but the
object view is different.
Yeah.
The object view means your software system is a collection of objects that can change over time,
mm-hmm,
during the runtime of the program. So objects can be created and they can be destroyed during processing. And each object can get messages from the outside and can produce information and give it to other objects. So there is an interaction between this system of objects, and there is no clear center, and there is no clear beginning and end of this this process.
Well, there's some duration of time during which this system of constructing a response to an input of some kind. I mean, the design of the animate design of these objects is a response to something, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So during that time, where I don't quite understand what you mean by objects being created and vanishing, it seems to me that the software would be designed to develop certain services within the problem solving environment that may be loaded and unloaded quickly during the work, but it still has.
I can give a simple example.
Uh-huh.
For example, if you start a word processor.
Uh-huh.
For example, Microsoft Word,
uh-huh,
then the software started and it is waiting for your input, for your command.
Right.
And then you tell him by clicking on the menu that you want to open the blob paper, for example.
Right. And then it says the computer has to crash, excuse us.
And now he reacts to that and builds an object.
Mm-hmm.
For the document as a whole.
Right.
But the document is complicated. It contains all kinds of formatting and your text.
It's all kind, yes,
so,
sure.
So without knowing the exact structure of what is built, we can assume that every character is a kind of object, that every paragraph is a kind of object, that every kind of overall formatting, everything that is contained is transferred into a kind of object, and they are all interconnected and related.
Right, and as you're talking, what I'm thinking of is the natural world corollary, which is going to the flower shop and buying some flowers, that you engage a process of developing a very complex communication with the florist, that she has to call up all kinds of relationships in response to my request and who I am and the kind of person the flowers are for. And she has to think of all this sort of stuff that she has to expand in her mind in the process of learning how to respond to me. And then responding and getting the money, which, you know, pays for her preparations to serve that need. So there's the energy throughput, and there's these periods of service, of generating the service. And so if you talk about the object as the thing that's generated in order to deliver the service, well, that's very much a corollary to how I've been using it. Now, perhaps other people are not. Won't understand it for immediately or
Actually, this kind of object-oriented programming is now much nearer to reality than programming was 30 years ago.
Meaning?
Because at that time, for example, the text that you typed in would, or the overall text would have been in an array, in a simple linear array of characters, for example.
Uh-huh.
And all kinds of structure would have had to was to be produced by a very difficult organizational, how should I say it? It was just difficult to come near to the reality.
Well, which reality? The fonts and so on?
Your reality, for example, of authoring a text.
Uh-huh.
Because such things as structural units, such objects that can be easily created and destroyed when they are needed or not needed anymore, it just did not exist.
It don't exist. What do you mean? Where don't they exist? I mean, the computer uses them.
At that time, you could only have data that you defined before the program started.
Uh-huh.
For example, I could have said, okay, I need an array of characters to hold all the text. But I would have said how big this area is, for example, a million characters, and then I could manipulate these characters during the runtime of the program.
Uh-huh.
It wouldn't have been flexible 30 years ago.
Right. When I got my first Macintosh, I got one of the first 128K Macintosh in the early 80s. And back then, code, I think, was linear strings and not what I gather it is now, sort of an environment.
So program has changed a lot. And actually, I think what happened in programming is the joining of data and process or relationships or dynamics has happened on a technical way. And I think that you actually quite correctly describe it now on the level of science, because you use also this under quotes, under double quotes, this context of data, such as you do not say it explicitly, but if you talk about an object-oriented science, then you would name the older natural science a data-oriented science.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to figure out what that means. I'm not sure how. I mean, to me, object-oriented science is a study of naturally occurring objects. You know, it's of whole systems, and whole systems would include computer responses to a question in this complex way that has evolved. That it's an emergence of a system, and that has a result and then disappearance of it.
But why then don't you call it system-oriented science?
Same thing.
Yeah.
It could be, except system-oriented science has unfortunately been used by science for a long time to mean these inanimate, rule-based equation systems, which cannot even address. I mean, this is the problem with science, as far as I'm concerned, is that scientific data to the present day has been unable to refer to any natural whole system. It can only refer to numbers. And so if data were to expand to include things, then I'd be fine with calling it data-oriented, but it won't, I don't think. And so I'm trying to position a term that's independent of the current logjam, it seems to me, as science wants to study natural forms but has no data structure that it can assign to a natural form. And that's what I see pattern language as doing, in that you can define in pretty nicely explicit ways the characteristics and boundaries of a natural form. And then say you're talking about that and in a fairly scientific way. But it's still a big leap. But to say it's system-oriented, I think, requires a different conception of system. I could say a pattern-oriented science and use the Alexander, or the evolving Alexander idea of what pattern is, but Alexander was himself pretty inconsistent in saying what patterns were. David West wrote a nice paper for PLOP on that question, showing that his first book on the my mind goes blank when I'm talking. On the notes on the synthesis of form, in that book, he refers to patterns and their relationships as evident in natural systems, and which he leaves out in a pattern language. And David does a really nice job on that, and I would recommend looking at it. So the question is how.
Is it in this book about the workshop book?
Oh, that's Purple Sock. No, that's the one in that book. Would 2014? I don't think so. No, he gave a talk that was just slides in the 2015 Purple Sock. And this new paper I'm referring to is his 2015 PLOP paper in Pittsburgh a few weeks ago. And he was in my writer's workshop group, so I got to read it and talk about it.
Is it published? Can I find it anywhere?
I It's not yet published. I can send it to you.
Yeah, would be great.
Okay.
Actually, I also think that Alexander, I wouldn't call it inconsistent, but there is a kind of progression in how he looks at this concept.
Uh-huh.
And between the notes on the synthesis of form, there's a large gap to a pattern language and timeless way of filling.
Oh, yeah.
And then another large step to nature of order.
Well, yes. I mean, I see in it, and I do gently comment on it in both my long papers, that he's overlooking quite entirely the thing that design is the creation of a structure for providing services to living things by living things, that design is inherently purposeful for being a bridge between one living network and another. So you have the service providing and the service receiving communities, and that is really where I think the liveliness either comes from or is destroyed. That either your design provides a wonderful home for the serving and served communities, or it doesn't, or it shortcuts them in some way. You know, like if you go to a restaurant where they don't have what you order on the menu, or they don't let you make simple exchanges on the menu, or, you know, various things that just show that they're not very thoughtful or generous, then you don't go back. So the quality of using a service and delivering a service is something that Alexander doesn't seem to address as if he, I mean, he really, kind of strangely to me, doesn't talk about the quality of designs as being how well they serve their public and how the public responds in healing in around the design, you know, even architectural designs. If you design a university building and people love to just hang out on the steps and talk after class, well, you've done a good thing. But if they just scurry away, you know, perhaps not.
But I think that he does address this in the way he asked that architecture is supporting life and in the way he's caring for the needs of the people before designing.
Oh, I agree entirely. He's saying that, but then he's not talking about the particularities of how it happens. I think it's clearly implied that you're serving your environment in a rewarding way for your environment. But I think that comes a lot from whether the environment likes what you're doing, whether it responds around you, and you know, whether the hot dog man comes to your corner or you know, any number of other things, whether you create whether
the rules of the system allow a hot dog man to exist, for example.
Well, yes, that has something to do with it, for sure. And whether it allows students with political issues to have a table outside or any number of other things. I mean, all those things matter. And so that's basically what I talk about in my PLOP paper, is thinking through the connections with the environment to see how well you serve them. And you know, because any software design will be in some way part of a system for joining human services that are serving the software and the human services and the human systems that are served by it. So we've covered a lot of the bases here, and not come up with a I don't know. Should I continue trying to use object-oriented science just to fill it out more, or what do you think?
Yes, I think it's important to try different approaches also in language.
Uh-huh.
Because every person out there, every scientist may resonate with some kind of approach and be pushed back by some kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people that that like these ideas of wholeness and of living systems and of feeling, and others shy away from it.
Right.
So we cannot know which wording will actually prevail or live on.
Well, that agrees very much with me. I think having an approach intended to share different perspectives on the same thing is what enriches them.
Yeah. And I also think that one important issue of pattern thinking or pattern research is that one actually creates language by first looking at the phenomena themselves and then becoming aware of them, then creating a name or concepts around them. Typically, people feel that language is just given, and language must correspond to reality. If the language exists, then there must be a corresponding reality, like a kind of magic.
Well, yes, it's a.
I think it's important to go beyond that, and if we are talking about the phenomena behind the wordings that we use, then this is an important kind of freedom if we do not discuss which word is right and which word is wrong.
Well, it also, to me, when you look at what words refer to in the natural world and what experiences they express the feelings and meanings of, if you talk about computer, well, it refers to an object that we have a lot of experiences with. It has a very clear origin, and everybody knows what you're talking about. But if you talk about stubbornness, you have a compound word that I'm not sure what stub and born have to do with together, but that's the root. If the stubborn, and then you add ness, it's meaning it has the continuity of that. And you think about all those situations in life where you confront stubbornness, and you begin to get, oh, no, I see what it's about. It's about something that resists pressure and has certain breaking points and has certain needs for other inputs. I mean, things are stubborn until they have the right input, usually. And so if you ask what the natural meaning of the word is and just look for all the different ways it's used, then you find lots of situations that help inform you on the nature of why the word had a sufficient importance for us to make a word out of it, or why the experience had that importance to, over, I presume, thousands of years, to keep using the same reference to this long held common experience. I find that both of my papers this year have sections on using compound words in that way to mine the experiences of our culture through looking at the various ways we use the terms. And it's really helped me an awful lot. I stumbled on it sort of like a couple years ago, and then found that it really helped my, or at least helped my writing. Whether it helped anybody else's reading yet, I'm not sure. But
just add to this discussion about liveliness or lebendigkeit science. I started a Facebook group a while ago.
Yeah.
It's German. And it's called Lebendigkeit Science.
Right.
Also Lebendigkeitswissenschaft. Wissenschaft is science in German.
Uh-huh.
So Lebendigkeitswissenschaft is liveliness science.
Uh-huh.
Or object-oriented science. And so I think I do this for a year. And there is a German cultural historian who coined the term enlightenment.
Uh-huh.
She sees a movement of enlightenment, a number of cultures of liveliness growing, and a kind of second age of enlightenment, an age of enlightenment. We coined the term. So it's rather easy in German to resonate with this idea.
What's her
name?
Name
is Hildegard Kurt, and she is in close connection with a rather well-known English woman, Shelley Sachs. Do you know the name Shelley Sachs?
Shelley Sachs, is that S-A-X?
S-A-C-K-S.
And Hildegard is, what's your last name?
I name it, I write it.
Oh, Kurt.
Shelley Sachs is in London. And more in arts and aesthetics. But to follow a similar idea, to make design more lively by involving people and by the idea that everyone is an artist.
Right. Now I've read other things along this line that are very, you know, they're not, aren't really, aren't really art science, but there are poetry and art, are philosophies of one or the other or both, and I don't know. I will definitely look them up and see if there's a connection. I mean, obviously there is, you know, emotionally in response to the age that we're in, that we're driven by a lifelessness. Science, actually, I mean, to coin a phrase, we can use the opposite, right? That we're driven by a lifelessness science of driven multiplication of money, you know, using economic profits to multiply our exploitation of each other and the earth. It's thought to, you know, that's the object of, you know, of our culture. That's what we're organized around, is using our ingenuity to multiply our ingenuity, which becomes then an enormous, unlivable burden in the end. What was I? I was going somewhere before I went off on my rap. Anyway, I'd like to find out what they're about. You think I'll find them just searching for their names?
Well, I'll try to give you a few.
Oh, there. Oh, okay.
And for example, this is a new website they use, Cultures of Enlightenment.
Right, cool.
So they have it, they have an English and German version of this. So there are certain traditions in philosophy and in cultural sciences that go in that direction, and they are way below the mainstream.
Well, yeah. Well, that's good that you have live.
It would be interesting if we can connect to them. Actually, I tried to connect, and maybe something will come out of it.
That would be good. One of my issues at present, as far as connection with others, is that part of the aim should be to make sure that pattern language has a common set of roots that people can understand each other in different communities by having common principles and understandings. So that would be one of the things, to understand each other's terminologies rather than set up, little fiefdoms and
But it's not easy to intrude into all these little gardens that people have built.
Well, Alexander built a little garden that exploded, So,
yeah.
So we want to keep the heart of what exploded.
Yeah. I smiled when I read your comparison with the six blind men and the elephant. With the scientists. It's a nice comparison.
Well, every once in a while, I find an apt way to tell that tale from a solutions point of view.
Okay.
All right. So.
Let's think it over and discuss it maybe in a week or two.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any time.
I'll try to look
great.
Up David West. Or could you send me the David West
paper? I don't have a link in my mind. It's pretty easy to get. I'll send it right to you.
Yeah. Actually, I think that there are a lot of small things to criticize on Alexander's approach.
Uh-huh.
But one has to find the right situation and the right people to discuss this.
Well,
usually people are, for example, Alexander followers, and then they are irritated when they face some criticism, any criticism.
Well, yeah, I mean, both at Purple Sock and at Plop in Pittsburgh, there were people reacting against the Christopher Alexander worship that tends to of using his name over and over in the introduction to every paper.
This is the other reaction.
Yeah.
Especially of old friends and colleagues.
Right.
But anyway, overdone.
My reason for mentioning that was that David West is teamed up with Jenny Quillian. They are critics. They're both anthropologists and very warm people and very, very intellectually sharp, and they're critics from a very positive side. And so, anyway, I will send that to you shortly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
See you.
Bye-bye. All right, so that was my Skype call with Helmut Leitner on November 28, 2015.